You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
March 22nd, 1915, Kerhook, Indiana. My dear Benson, your communication of the 18th has just been received and carefully read. In the closing paragraph, you assure me that you are not in the least irritated. And yet, I must conclude that you must have been at least a little bit heated in what you had to say in answer to my letter. You doubtless preserved a copy, and if you will look it over and note the number of I's in it, appears to me strangely out of place. Yours fraternally, Eugene V. Debs. Eugene Debs had been the socialist candidate for president in 1912, where he received 900,000, almost a million votes. And just to put that in perspective, we are not talking about the tiny, you know, socialist party of the United States that might have an office in the second floor of Ashtabula, Ohio, or something like that. This is a serious movement. 900,000 votes is something like 10 million votes if you compare it to the election of 2020. However, because the party is branded with that word socialism, kind of a boogeyman of our times, but Alan Benson, who is a socialist newspaper publisher in New York, getting some kind of fame, did indeed write Debs a letter that did indeed have a lot of I's in it. I have your letter of the 19th. I've read it with interest. I did not know that German socialists had ever demanded the democratization of the war-making power. I do not care if they did. I am not trying to be a hero. I am trying to end war. I know how to dress windows. I am going to keep at the job until it's done. Yeah, we're a paragraph in, and I don't know, was that a dozen I's? Alan Benson, the best way for me to describe it is think of like the podcaster or blogger of today. He's kind of the new media sensation within the socialist movement in the teens. And Eugene Debs is the somewhat old labor guy who the hero of the Pullman strike of 1896. Alan Benson's big cause, he wants before the United States goes to any war that Americans vote on it, that the entire people have a referendum. And Debs does not really like Benson's idea so much. And then Benson wrote that response, which the slightest breath of approval from you, Benson writes to Debs about his idea, or anybody who had power could turn the scale towards victory now. So a very important decision that's ignored by most histories of the 1916 election, which only will have to do with something that occurs in a hotel room in California. We're going to talk about that in part three, of course. And Wilson and Hughes and the war and everything like that. Very few accounts address socialism at all. And that's maybe because of the taboo of it. Or because, you know, even though they got would be the equivalent of 10 million votes, it's not enough. Well, they are. And what happens here between Benson, it's not just about Benson being irritated or not, or Debs, who tend to have a small C conservative way about him, even though he's the leading socialist figure, he was like extremely frugal. Two things are going on with Debs. One is that he's very sick. He feels if he were to do a national campaign now, which is going to involve a lot of train riding and speaking, and because it's the socialists, every speech has to include a large amount of fundraising and small money donors too. It's exhausting. He's also decided that, you know, even if he did nearly get a million votes, he's still not president. And so, at least in this year, he decides to run for his local congressional seat. Whatever we think of socialists today, look at their positions in 1950, right? Unrestricted and equal suffrage for men and women. The adoption of the initiative, referendum, and recall. The election of the president and the vice president by the direct vote of the people.
the amendment of the Constitution by a majority of voters in the country, the abolition of the power usurped by the Supreme Court of the United States to pass upon the constitutionality of legislation enacted by Congress, national laws to be repealed only by act of Congress, the election of all judges of the United States, the granting of the right of suffrage in the District of Columbia, the freedom of press, speech, and assemblage, the increase of rates of the present income tax and corporation tax, and extension of inheritance taxes, the proceeds of these taxes to be employed in the socialization of industry. Now, I'm not going to pretend that that one isn't controversial, but there's many others here that are pretty normal. The enactment of further measures for the conservation of health and the creation of an independent department of health. The Bureau of Education to be made a department. Well, this was 1916 and Carter did it in 1977, so there you go. The abolition of the Senate and the veto power of the president. Those are debatable, but there are many people today who want that. The collective ownership and democratic management of railroads, telegraphs, telephones, express service, steamboat lines, and all other social means of transportation and communication, and of all large-scale industries. Government relief of the unemployed by the extension of all useful public works. So look, I mean, this is parts of the socialist platform of 1916. The handbook that they give to the socialist speakers out there is going to say, the issue is, where's the issue? Look at civil service, look at rural delivery, look at monopolies. The two parties have the same positions. Look at suffrage, same positions. They both say they want the states to do something and shift the responsibility there. Vote socialist. There's no difference between the two. In the excitement of 1916 and with Debs bowing out, suffice it to say what happens in 1916 is that the kind of turn-of-the-century bloggers, if you will, take over the Socialist Party from Debs and take that crusade, and they'll be the candidates on the ballot. Alan Benson and George Ross Kirkpatrick, he is a New Jersey socialist newspaper publisher, and Kirkpatrick is big for having come up with this really good anti-war pamphlet, War What For, pointing out how the capitalists want war, but refuse to fight in them. It's always the working men that fight in the wars and etc. You might say, oh, so two men are running on the socialist ticket. And that's true. But Kirkpatrick did face competition from Catherine Richards O'Hare, who also ran for the vice presidential nominee of the party. So the socialists are already thinking about including women in politics. Yeah, real radical stuff, right? What you don't have is a name like Debs. And that will be critical. And yet, few historians talk about it. From the Breckinridge News, June 14th, 1916. The Democratic Party goes to St. Louis on the banks of the Mississippi to hold its 22nd National Convention. The new convention hall, said to be the finest in the world, will be the scene. And although there is no doubt as to who the nominee will be, interest is at its height. The party platform will be adopted. Wilson will be nominated and a chairman of the National Committee to succeed. William McCombs, resigned, will be chosen. The convention this year is in striking contrast to that held in Baltimore 4 years ago. Then the nomination belonged to anyone, and Wilson was not nominated until the 46th ballot. Perhaps the most interesting feature of this convention will be the attitude that William J. Bryan, three times nominated by the Democrats and three times defeated, takes towards Woodrow Wilson. It was due to the Commoners' hold on the Baltimore Convention that Wilson emerged victorious over Champ Clark in 1912. Bryan was then made Secretary of State and resigned because he didn't agree with the administration's foreign policy and preparedness plans. One of the unique features about the approaching convention is the fact that there will be 15 women delegates. Kansas, California, and Washington have chosen four women delegates each. Arizona has chosen one, and Wyoming, two. It has been 84 years since the first National Democratic Convention was called at the behest of Andrew Jackson, then president, to nominate the man whom he wished to serve with him as vice president during his second term. Jackson's popularity with his own party was so unquestioned that he was nominated as first Democratic National Convention by acclamation. And at that convention, the keynote speaker is a man named Martin Glynn. Glynn is the governor of the great state of New York and the first Irishman to hold that office. And he's the National Party's batter-up speaker. He's the keynote here in St. Louis. For him, he seeks to make no slogan or change history. No, he's just going to emphasize that Wilson, like George Washington, like all the American presidents we've had so far, is advocating a position of not entangling the nation in foreign disputes. He goes through history and cites times when a president didn't go to war. He talks about the examples of Washington. He talks about the example of John Adams and the French crisis, Grover Cleveland and the Venezuelan crisis, Andrew Jackson, the French crisis. I don't want to enumerate them all, Glynn says. And the crowd, however, does. Go on, go on. Glynn realizes he's got this crowd. After each example, he says, basically, this happened, say, with Andrew Johnson and the payments owed us because of the Trent Affair. We didn't go to war. Talks about Van Buren. This is a Democratic convention. So he talks about Franklin Pierce. After all, Franklin Pierce is to them. John Kennedy is to us almost the same time difference. I know, crazy, right? But we didn't go to war. This happened, that happened, but we didn't go to war. Presidents kept the peace. The crowd goes wild. In fact, as he's citing these examples, anticipating Glynn, the crowd's already starting to say, what did we do? And Glynn responds dutifully. We didn't go to war. Here's what one writer, Walter Millis, says of St. Louis Democratic National Convention. Pacifism had been jeered at, made to seem in opposition to Americanism, until people who favored peace with Europe came to feel almost apologetic about it. Now, here, they were being told that when history was considered, they were right, the others were wrong. This policy does not satisfy those who revel in the destruction and find pleasure in despair. It may not satisfy the fire eater or the swashbuckler, but it does satisfy those who worship at the altar of the God of Peace. There are shouts, there are cheers. It does satisfy the mothers of the land, at whose hearth and fireside no jingoistic war has placed an empty chair. Now, the official Democratic Party starts to get a little worried. You know, Woodrow Wilson didn't endorse a pacifist convention. He wanted Americanism, vague combination of patriotism, standing up for American rights, not kowtowing to foreign lobbies, no hyphenates, all of those things. Americanism was to be the theme. Senator John Smith of Maryland passes Glynn a note. And the note says, be sure to add in, but we will fight if necessary. And Glynn has got the crowd going. He looks at the card mid-speech and hands it back to Smith and says, I'll get to that. And right back to his speech. The daughters of this land, from whom brag and bluster have sent no husband, no sweetheart, and no brother to the smoldering disillusion of the grave. And then he does the line that Smith and the more conservative factions were looking for. It does satisfy the fathers of the land who will fight. The crowd is silent. When reason primes the rifle. And here in Glynn's statement, there's a little bit of the answer to those who will later claim that the 1916 message was deceitful. That he ever said he won't go to war. It's not said at this convention. Glynn doesn't say it. In fact, here he says. Talks about preparedness. When justice breathes a blessing on the standards with which they uphold, men will fight and will die for this flag, but not before. The next day, it's Ole James, a giant man from Kentucky. He had, as the New York Times said, the face of a prize fighter and the body of an oak. Without orphaning a single American child, without widowing a single American mother, without shedding a single drop of blood, he wrung from the most militant spirit an acknowledgement of American rights. No one at this convention actually voices the words, "He kept us out of war," that will be associated with this convention. After Ole James, the moment that the Breckinridge News anticipated, William Jennings Bryan, who had left Wilson's administration because of the preparedness policy, gets up. He was talked about possibly challenging Wilson in a primary. He speaks, "I join with the American people in thanking God we have a president who doesn't want this country plunged into war." 1 million dead in a single multi-week battle, but still a single mad battle. 1 million dead. As this convention is starting, we're about to start Verdun. That's going to be bloody for both the French and the Germans. You know, where essentially the Germans just decide, we're just going to kill you out of this war, even if we take casualties. We're just going to make it so bloody for you. You have Canada and Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, far from the battlefield in France, sending large amounts of men who are dying there. And Americans do feel sympathy for the Belgians, other combatants. They feel sympathy for Paris with enemy soldiers nearly in sight. There is an acknowledgement here at this convention that Wilson has achieved a goal, a foreign policy goal already. It's a victory. The time has kind of erased because of what happened afterwards in 1917. But people forget that there were 3 years of war before that. I mean, don't take my word for it. Look at the movies and books and statements that occurred around World War II where Wilson is portrayed as a hero for having that foresight, for keeping us out of war during its most bloody period, and then putting America in when we could be most influential and attempting to build an international peace so it wouldn't happen again. All of those things. Because of the speeches, they're going to introduce a platform plank that says, "He kept us out of war." Never spoken at the convention, but that becomes the slogan. The Democrats have this revival meeting. The party's all excited. The numbers are still ugly. If they remember, in 1912, 1.3 million people voted against him more than those who voted for him.
"I deny that the American people have surrendered to any set of men, no matter what their position or their character."
So there's a lot of intrigue that goes on now with Theodore Roosevelt.
"The final right to determine those fundamental questions upon which free self-government ultimately depends."
Who, if you remember, in 1912 ran for president in a three-way split, ran against Taft and Wilson. So he split the Republican Party in doing that. At the time of the 1916 convention, the Republicans are meeting in Chicago. He's trying to engineer something difficult, but, you know, he is kind of a political superhero of this time and thinks maybe he can do it. And that is, he wants to get the Republican and progressive nominations and then run against Wilson. So he's got this delicate balancing act. He can never quite tell the progressives, "I'll accept your nomination," but he can't say, "I'll decline your nomination." And the same to the Republicans. And it's the day before the Republican convention, and the Republicans have pretty much settled on a conservative leadership. So the folks that were supporting Taft back in 1912 are putting on the show in Chicago. And they've decided that their keynote speaker is going to be Warren G. Harding. Now, it's a funny thing, because the first thing that you should know about that is if when we hear the name Warren G. Harding, we know he's going to be president later. But also, wasn't he supposed to be like a dark horse that they just came up with in 1920? And you see here that he's the keynote speaker in 1916. He's also the temporary convention chairman. No, Warren Harding is well known in the Republican Party. And so he and a group of governors loyal to the conservative part of the Republican Party and less to Roosevelt are kind of running the show. Roosevelt is asked by a delegate in Maryland, would he consider coming to Chicago and speaking to the convention? And this leads to, and this is a very common thing in those days, someone will write a letter responding to someone knowing full well it's going to end up in the newspapers because they're a famous person like Theodore Roosevelt. And that's what happens. And he responds and he says, first of all, he warns the Republican Party that there are, and he's thinking specifically about German Americans, there are foreign alliances seeking to take this convention and use it for their interests, and don't be fooled. And he has a lot of other things to say. Wilson's failed the country. He knows that. The Republicans should unify. These are good notes for the Republicans in Chicago to hear. And at the end, he says, I would gladly speak to the Republican Party convention, you know, if I was invited by that body. This is a little bit of drama for the conservatives running the Chicago convention, but Chairman Warren Harding simply says, you know, that they've received the telegram from Roosevelt. They welcome his support of the Republican Party. In terms of Colonel Roosevelt speaking at the meeting, that would have to be decided by the convention. The chairman, Warren Harding, couldn't decide to do that arbitrarily. Of course, no one calls for a vote to allow Colonel Roosevelt to speak. And so he does not speak at the convention. Absent a speech at that Republican convention, which could lead to a stampede, there's no chance that Roosevelt's going to be nominated at this meeting. And so what you have is that Roosevelt is nominated by the Progressive or Bull Moose Party. We're going to talk about that in a second, because that's going to lead to some drama and tears. And the Republicans are going to nominate their own candidate, Charles Evans Hughes. Republicans nominate Hughes, Progressives nominate Roosevelt. Now, much to the chagrin of the progressives, he's going to issue a statement that he will decline the Bull Moose nomination, the progressive nomination. But he says, my declination, this is a very Roosevelt-type statement, my declination will stand if Hughes turns out to be sound on the issues of Americanism and preparedness. But if Hughes turns out to be pacifistic, pussy-footed, or pro-German, I'll accept the progressive nomination and make a race of it. This leads to something that hasn't happened before. Normally, you wait for the committee to show up, and then you make your official acceptance as a candidate. Justice Hughes accepts the nomination by telegraph and also indicates that he will resign and send a note to Woodrow Wilson that he's resigning from the Supreme Court. He doesn't wait for the formal notification. This breaks all records. And he declared his position that he agrees with everything that Colonel Roosevelt indicated. He's not going to get directly into it. And he agrees with the Republican platform. So Warren Harding refuses Roosevelt's offer to speak to the convention, knowing full well that could just lead to problems. But have no doubt, he feels confident that the Republicans, as they are, can take on Wilson and win America. That 1912 was just a temporary fluke. And Harding will be the keynote speaker. So he's going to present a very different message from the Democrats. You're not going to hear in the Republican convention, not in this keynote speech, we kept the country out of war. Instead, it's typical thing you do when you're the opposition party, attack, attack, attack. And Harding says, the country is weary afresh by a disappointing and distressing Democratic administration. Harding has to admit that in 1912, the Republicans let the country down by splitting in half. We did not do very well in managing harmony the last time we met. The country has regretted it. Let us forget and make amends to our country.
We did not divide under fundamental principles. We did not disagree over national policy. We split over methods, over party procedure, and preferred personalities. Let us forget the differences and find new inspiration. We have witnessed the comeback of our party in various states. Harding's part of this comeback. In the 1914 midterm, Harding, a Republican, won in Ohio. So he's one of the stars of the party from that. No apology has been asked. No forswearing required. This is not the time of recrimination. It is the day of reconsecration. He says a phrase that is the same thing Wilson has said. And that's why I used it as the title of this series. Everything is different, Harding says. Everything is different. Everything is abnormal, except the depletion of the federal treasury. That is normal when Democrats are in control. And with that, he gets cheers. We have hungered in vain for that unflinching Americanism in Washington, which is needed to exalt the American soul. Foreign powers are not sure of the commitment of the American people with the current administration. There's no geographic modification of American rights. They are the same in Mexico that they are in the high seas, the same in Europe that they are in Asia, and they're sacred everywhere. Harding's going to attack Wilson because in his Mexico policy, we didn't talk about much so far in this series, but Wilson's going to intervene in Mexico in 1913 and then in 1916. And Mexico's in a revolution right now. The whole country's full of violence. And Americans were brought into it, particularly the border towns. Republicans again are going to make this argument that Wilson showed you in Mexico that he wasn't able to conclude anything. And the European powers are looking at that and saying America's weak. Under the pretext of non-interference, the Democratic administration miserably meddled in Mexico. They coddled Villa like a patriot, and then they chased him like a bandit. In contrast, Harding said if the Republicans were in charge, all they would have to do is voice their position to Mexico, and all would be taken care of. As to Europe, justice points the safe way through the channel of neutrality. There are dangers, seeming or real, looming on every side, but we should feel secure along the course marked by international law and our own convictions of American rights. And then Harding points out, we don't need to have the greatest navy in the world. That's not America. But we ought to have a navy that fears none in the world. I want to point out something in the middle of this Harding speech, and you see kind of the Republican position separate from Theodore Roosevelt. You're not seeing Harding in this keynote talk about diving into war. The Republicans aren't going to say we kept you out of war. Harding has to deal with one other thing, and it's a problem if you're running against any incumbent president. Economic times in 1916 are actually pretty good. There was a slight dip. There was a recession in 1914. But now things are pretty good. So you've got to attack that prosperity. You've heard modern politicians do this, you know. It's like, oh, there's prosperity, but it's not real. No one disputes a temporary prosperity in our land today. But it is sectional in its factory aspect, abnormal and fictitious and perverting in its tendency. Worse, it is the gold sluiced from the river of blood. God forbid that we should boast a prosperity wrought in such a waste of human life. What's Harding talking about? America is getting millions. Sales of automobiles, sales of guns, sales of horses, sales of... I remember visiting Fort Worth, where there was a old horse corral and of course, cattle pens and the like. And there's a plaque there that says that 1915, 1916, 1917 were the best years they ever had in terms of sales, because you still require a lot of horse and cattle for war in World War I. So Harding's saying, yeah, we're prosperous under Wilson right now, and we can't deny it. We would look like fools if we did, but it's a fake prosperity. It's just based on the war. The Democrats proclaimed the security of Americans on the high seas, and then did nothing. They made promises, and then they profaned them. Verily, it is good to be an American. And we may rejoice to be Republicans. Cheers fill the hall. He goes on for an hour, and it's a Democratic newspaper that says he did a great job, compared Warren Harding to Burke Cochran, who we talked about in the Grover Cleveland episode, who's an expert orator, and compared him to the athleticism of a swimmer as well. Like, he's just moving and gyrating his hands, and the crowd loves it. And you have here the answer to Woodrow Wilson of the Democratic administration. It's just simply restore the Republicans. We messed up 4 years ago. We'll put it together. You see, Roosevelt's with us now. We'll put it together, and we'll be back, and Europe's going to respect us, and Mexico, all we need is to say one word, and they'll behave if the right people are in charge. As I indicated, Harding, there's actually a group that wants Harding to be the nominee for president. Now, that would be a very conservative choice, as it was in 1920. He doesn't get it. Instead, they go with Charles Evans Hughes, which is an appeal to the progressives. It doesn't get a lot of airtime in history, but there is a Bull Moose convention. The Bull Moose Party is what Theodore Roosevelt ran on in 1912 when he got mad at the Republican convention, railroaded him in 1912, and nominated Taft, the current president at the time, and he formed his own Bull Moose Party. That party lives on a little in that they have a convention.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. To follow trends, track financial situations, follow gains and losses, check out the Yahoo Finance Podcast. Every day, we'll give you a quick overview of the latest market and financial news that you need to know. You'll be able to hear about the biggest headlines in the business world in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. It's perfect to listen to while you make another cup of coffee or work out a new budget. Check it out now. Listen to Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
And some well-known people are there. William Allen White, Ida Tarbell, and well-known progressives are there. But Roosevelt, in late statements to friends and such, is not too keen on this idea. And he's given indications that he's going to be a party man now. He broke in 1912, and he wants to be a Republican now. What he really wants is the Republican nomination. But at this Bull Moose convention, he sends word, why don't you nominate my friend Henry Cabot Lodge? What? He's a Bourbon conservative, not a progressive. So the Bull Moose convention is in a quandary here. They can't nominate a candidate. The convention chair, just to try to avoid a riot in the building, keeps this declination from Roosevelt until the last minute as the convention is closing. William Allen White says, men, hundreds of them, tore the Roosevelt picture from their lapels. Ida Tarbell said, "A great and noble body of people deserved better than a cowardly stab that their leader gave it." These are remarks of significance as we try to understand what's going to happen in the actual election. But eventually it's decided they'll go along with Hughes. That's the end of the Bull Moose Party. Insulted, perhaps, but maybe not injured, because the Republicans did nominate that Charles Evans Hughes, and so the voters that the Bull Moose Party got in the 1912, even if the VIP progressives may be mad, the voters that voted for Roosevelt in 1912, they may very well like Charles Evans Hughes. Somebody else who likes him is William Howard Taft. In fact, it was his suggestion. Taft is a jurist. He likes the idea of a jurist entering the presidency. The Wilson people think it's a great choice and are, you know, think it's going to be a tough competitor. Here's Joseph Tumulty. He says, "There was deep depression in Democratic ranks, the opinion being that Hughes was an invincible foe." He was above the dust and clamor of all the GOP splits. He was on the court in 1912 when all of that disagreement had in the Republican Party, when that happened. He wasn't commenting on politics. And guess what? He was in the court during all the developments with Britain and Germany in the war, during all of the U-boat controversy, the submarines. He didn't comment on it. He was a political submarine hiding under the water, waiting to emerge. And now he had. Roosevelt's friends would probably all vote for him, and Taft, his friends, put him up. Hughes is an interesting combo because he's both supported good government and taken on businesses who engaged in fraud. And that's how he got his name out and became governor, taking on some of the insurance companies. He's totally silent on the controversial questions. Something else. The GOP in nominating Hughes doesn't say, "We kept you out of war." But they telegraph that they are in no rush. See, if they wanted to signal that they were going to jump into the European war, they'd nominate Roosevelt or a Roosevelt friend. Leonard Wood was available, his general in the Spanish-American War. That's probably what they would have needed to do. In Hughes, there was a sense, the New York Times said, that the Republicans wanted Wilsonian policies under a Republican auspices. Or, as Theodore Roosevelt more bluntly put it, Hughes was a whiskered Wilson, and he had a few thoughts about how Hughes as president was going to utilize him or take his advice. But nonetheless, there were posters out there with Teddy's face saying, "I support Charles Evans Hughes for president." And those posters were handed out by the RNC. Hughes dines with Roosevelt. He also dines with Taft. Unity. Eventually, they get Taft and Roosevelt to dine together as well. Few people are fooled by that. But something else. Charles Evans Hughes is kind of a Herculean campaigner. Immediately, having not been involved in issues at all, he does have a legal mind, a lot, ability to read a lot, some say a photographic memory. He reads every article he can, all the books he can, all the positions on various issues. He travels by train. He will go 25,000 miles traveling around in this campaign. His first nomination acceptance is at Carnegie Hall. He makes a general statement about an efficient America, standing up for American rights. But he also goes to visit Montana copper mines and descends into the mine with them. He goes to Bear Lake in the Rockies and climbs 10,000 feet up. He goes to see the Detroit Tigers game and speaks to tens of thousands of workers how much better it's going to be under the Republican ticket. When he sees Ty Cobb in the outfield, the star, he leaps over the rail to shake Ty Cobb's hand. You can see film of Charles Hughes speaking. We'll put it on the website at www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. We'll put a link up to that. And just really finding his groove, really being authoritative and speaking to the issues. In terms of issues, no one could ignore the side argument of 1916, the woman's vote. In the halls of St. Louis, as Democrats heard Glenn and James and Brian, none of them spoke to the direct issue of the women's vote. This is because at the current time, women could not vote. There were a few delegates there, and some states, Wyoming, Utah, California, and also Illinois. So not just like way out west states, about 12 states allowed women to vote, but not nationally. Sometimes this came from a progressive place, these states allowing women to vote, like all people should be equal, all people should participate, it's a democracy. And sometimes it came from a less progressive thinking. In other words, some states, they were worried about people wandering into their states and then voting, and allowing women to vote was a way to double up on a settler family's vote, where some of the people moving in were bachelors. Whether it was from a progressive or conservative place, nonetheless, in these states, the right was enacted. Tried in New York, not yet successful. It hadn't reached the nation yet. In St. Louis, this is a problem. Large numbers of representatives bedecked with bright yellow sashes, ribbons, and parasols filled the galleries, vociferously demanding a sweeping declaration of their approval, approval of their plank. And their plank was not Woodrow Wilson's plank, nor was it the GOP plank. Both parties' plank left the issue to the states. But, to throw a bone, both of them, as national parties, the RNC and DNC, directed those states, encouraged those states to allow voting for women. So in other words, we're going to leave the issue to you, but we hope you'll do it. That's basically Woodrow Wilson's position and is the GOP platform position. The suffragists want a constitutional amendment. At this time, they're protesting government buildings. They're protesting at the White House very often. It's a really tricky issue for both parties because for the Democrats, they have that solid South. And this is not an issue well-liked in the Deep South, allowing women to vote. But it's not so different for the Republicans because there are a few states, New England states, Massachusetts, for instance, was a very strong anti-suffragist movement, strong sense of tradition, almost equal to the conservatism of the Southern states. And Massachusetts is going to be one of the last states, by the way, to ratify the 19th. They do, but they'll be one of the last states to do it. And some of the Southern states never ratified it until the 1950s. So that's the predicament that both parties are in. And so that's Woodrow Wilson's plank. They have a vote on the suffragist plank, and it is defeated 888 delegates to 181 against the woman's suffrage and for Woodrow Wilson's more conservative plank. At the time of the GOP convention, there's a separate meeting in Colorado where a national women's party is founded. And they say they will work in those 12 suffrage states to defeat Woodrow Wilson, unless his party changes his position on the suffrage issue. At the same time, women like Alice Paul are warning the Republican Party, don't take our votes for granted. Don't think just as a protest to Woodrow Wilson, who isn't doing anything, we're going to vote for you to not do anything. You cannot just expect our votes. Now, Charles Evans Hughes, pundits, even Republicans are going to criticize Charles Evans Hughes for making these really general statements. But he doesn't get credit for what he does on this issue. A day after the Carnegie Hall speech, when Hughes accepts the nomination, because in those days, presidential candidates didn't go to conventions generally. There's a few exceptions. Generally, they're not present at the conventions. A committee sent to meet them near their home or somewhere there and offer the nomination. And that's when you make the speech. When he does that, he doesn't say anything on this issue. But the next day, Hughes gets a letter from a Utah senator. Utah allows women to vote. And he answers it. And Hughes says, "My view is that the amendment should be submitted and it should be ratified. And then the subject would be removed from political discussion." It's no mistake, because Hughes repeats the statement he made to the Utah senator at a New York Women's League meeting the same day. He phrases it as a conservative point. In other words, we have to take this issue off so that we can deal with the more serious issues pressing the nation. Mostly, surprise, surprise, it's going to be dismantling all of the new freedom programs that Wilson had brought in. But here's the thing. In supporting an amendment to the Constitution, Hughes has now moved away from his GOP platform and from the Democratic platform as well, and from Woodrow Wilson's position, and taken a step further to what the suffragists want. This is going to force Wilson's hand. And so Wilson gets asked by a significant suffragist leader, "Well, you've heard Mr. Hughes, what are you going to do?" And Wilson is a bit outflanked. He doesn't take Hughes's position and support a constitutional amendment. What Wilson says is, "If I were to change my position now, you'd think me an angler for votes. So I'm not going to do that. Also, I believe that the state's method is a quicker way to get what you want than a constitutional amendment." And to be fair to his position, a constitutional amendment is tough. You got to get 3/4 of the legislatures to ratify. But in reality, given the behavior in some of the more anti-suffragist states, it was never going to happen there. So a national amendment probably was the way to get it done. And that's the way history turned out with the 19th, although it did take more time. We're talking about, this is 1916 we're talking about. So again, for a candidate that everyone says he took no positions, and it's true, some of the statements are wobbly, particularly around the war. We're going to get into that. Here he just outflanked Wilson and threw something at his door. Wilson's response is not going to be enough, and he's going to have to deal with this issue further. From W.E.B. Du Bois to President Woodrow Wilson, September 1913. "Sir, on the occasion of your inauguration as President of the United States, the crisis," this is the newspaper, the NAACP, which Du Bois is the editor of, "took the liberty of addressing to you in an open letter. The crisis spoke for no inconsiderable part of tens of millions of human beings, American-born American citizens," talking about African Americans. "Sir, you have now been president of the United States for 6 months. And what is the result? It is no exaggeration to say that every one of our enemies, every enemy of our race, is greatly encouraged by you. Every man who dreams of making us a group of menials and pariahs is encouraged by you. Vardaman, racist senator from Mississippi. Tillman, racist senator from South Carolina. Hoke Smith, Cole Bleece, Albert Burleson are evidently assuming that their theory of the place and destiny of us is the theory of your administration. They're assuming it because not a single act or a single word of yours has stopped them, has given anyone a reason to infer that you have the slightest interest in the colored people." This is Du Bois' letter of September 1913, and we'll come back to it. It became immediately visible that upon the election of Woodrow Wilson, that two departments in particular, the post office, headed up by Albert Burleson of Texas, and the treasury, headed up by William Gibbs McAdoo, originally from the South, but now of California nominally, these two departments have started to segregate African Americans who are working there. This is how William Du Bois describes it. "In the Treasury and Post Office departments, colored clerks have been herded to themselves as though they were not human beings. We are told that one colored clerk who would not actually be segregated on account of the nature of his work has been consequently had a cage built around him to separate him from his white companions of many years. Mr. Wilson, do you know these things? Are you responsible for them? Did you advise them?
Do you not know that no other group of American citizens has ever been treated in this way? And that no president of the United States has dared to propose such treatment? It's a plain, flat, disgraceful, spitting in the face of people. Do you consent to this, President Wilson? There have been other approaches to Wilson on this issue. Another one that's notable is Oscar Garrison Fillard. Now, he is the grandson of William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionist, and he heads up the New York Evening Post. He meets with Wilson right after it's apparent of what's going on. And prior to the election, there was a lot of hope that Woodrow Wilson, although nominally was a Southerner, he was really seemed to be from New Jersey, representing New Jersey's Princeton president. His Southernness had been contained somewhat, and he was a progressive politically. And so Du Bois and others are going to hang their hopes on this, that Wilson's going to be, as president, a liberal. From the start, this seems impossible. But one of the things that Villard had suggested to Wilson before the election, and they had a good talk on it, was to have a nonpartisan commission. It's going to say, look, you have all these complaints of Southern people, and the largest complaint, the thing that starts the NAACP, is race riots really caused by white people rioting and killing and taking things from black citizens and lynchings. And states aren't enforcing the law. And so African-American citizens have complaints. Let's have a nonpartisan commission. You're going to be the first Democratic president in a while. What a great opportunity to have a nonpartisan commission to look at the problems that black people are having. And Wilson seems like he's amenable to the idea. He does tell Villard at that time, which might have been a red flag, let me get to know the Southerners in Congress better than I do now first. Okay. Now Villard, having seen what happened with the Treasury and the post office departments, brings up this idea again. Let's have that commission we talked about. Now Wilson has a different characterization of it. No, Villard, if we did that nonpartisan commission, it would look like an indictment of the South. Why should we be concerned with the feelings of Southern senators? What about a search for the truth, Villard says. And Wilson, to hear Villard's description, kind of puts on an act. It's either, as really the modern take is, that Wilson's just a racist and there's no point in even thinking about him in any kind of nuance. Just a racist and doesn't want to do anything. Or, as I'm more inclined to believe, some scholars more inclined to believe, the enormous political pressures on him. And he's also not standing up to it. So Burleson is a member of his cabinet, heads up the post office. Most of the civil service jobs are there. McAdoo heads up Treasury. That's probably the second department where most of the civil service jobs are. They're also the two people who were arm-twisting in Congress to pass all of Wilson's enormous pile of legislation. And some of these things enhance the size of the federal government. Well, the Federal Reserve Bill, for instance, the income tax. Like, this is not something that Southerners generally are for. Well, why do they get their votes? Well, to make them feel better about it in exchange, this has been a longstanding request, which Southern senators complain, this is Vanderman's, that they're getting so many complaints from white civil service workers that they have to work with African Americans. If you do this, this will make us feel more comfortable about expanding the size of the federal government, because we'll know the federal government's with us, so to speak. It's an ugly trade, if this is indeed what happened. So there is a little bit of nuance with Wilson and resegregating the federal government. He does not do it by presidential order. There is no announcement of it. In fact, something that has to be discovered when the NAACP and others start getting complaints from these federal workers. It's not something that's announced in the newspapers. We're resegregating the federal government under Wilson. Now, the other thing to say, and it's only a limited defense of Wilson, it's not much, is that Wilson doesn't order it. He tolerates it. Newton Baker, Secretary of War, his original Secretary of War, his
Secretary of Labor, they do not segregate their departments in this way. Wilson does not order them to do so. Here's Patricia O'Toole, the moralist, Woodrow Wilson, and the world he made. The overt segregation has been ascribed to the fact that the president and half his cabinet were native Southerners. While such attitudes undoubtedly played a part, there was another potent force at work. Virtually all the new segregation occurred in the departments happened to be run by the same two who were twisting congressional arms on behalf of the president's legislation. Most of the Democrats opposing Wilson's economic reforms were Southerners, who feared that Wilson's drive for more federal control would eventually lead to federal abolition of state laws that segregated virtually every aspect of life. Southern Democrats in Congress praised the changes in the federal government. They wanted more. Freshman congressman in Oklahoma demanded segregation of all federal offices. Senator James K. Vardaman of Mississippi wanted that, and he wanted to repeal the 14th and 15th. So, while it's not an excuse for history, and it's never going to make Wilson look much better, you want to be careful about going too far in describing how it happened, as if it was like Wilson's personal choice or whim. We can debate whether he liked it, he secretly giggled about it, or whether he was secretly distressed about it. I mean, we won't know the answer to that. But there is a lot of political forces. When you're a Democrat in the 19th or the early 20th century, you're elected by Southern states. That's the only way you get in. The Republicans are dominant in the North. And this goes all the way to the Kennedy era. That's the politics. It's easy. I always will point out that it's easy for a Republican to be a blowhard about civil rights when their votes don't really depend on an area where that's a problem. And that's, I think, what you see in the Republican Party. There's a lot of statements about what they're going to do in to the region that votes Democrat anyway. You know, so when you're a Democrat elected, as Woodrow Wilson is, all your political support's coming from a region that wants this. On the other hand, you can't defend Wilson because it seemed like this guy that has stood up to New Jersey political bosses and will stand up to others, will stand up to European leaders at the conference table, was a scarecrow when it came time to his own political forces and seemed willing to trade. He does have to have these meetings, not only Villard, who goes away disappointed. Wilson uses every excuse in the book. I can't do it right now, Villard. Actually, I'm secretly trying to do as much as I can for African Americans. You have to understand. But I can't publicize all of that. I won't be able to play my hand. Villard doesn't buy it. William Monroe Trotter is going to come in, an African American significant editor, and meet with the president in 1914, after there's a petition, after they get a commitment from Wilson to investigate the resegregation of the federal government, and he never does. Now there's a petition, and Trotter says, okay, Mr. President, we're going to vote against you. You know that. Leave politics out of it. Wilson tells Trotter, this is a human problem. Trotter says, people like me who supported you in 1912 are now being considered traitors in our party. I'm being harassed by other African-American leaders for having supported you. Is there nothing you can do on this issue? This is not a question of intrinsic quality. We all have souls, Wilson says. Friction is deep in America. It takes the world generations to outlive prejudices. What about economic equality, Trotter says. We can do things with equal efficiency. Prove that, Wilson says, and a lot of things will solve themselves. This is the kind of explanation that behind closed doors Wilson gives. And, you know, in modern times, boy, it's really a paper tiger. It's pretty easy to dismiss it, but, you know, he's at least playing this thread. Oh, these are huge problems. There's nothing I can do to solve it in just a year. You were heralded 2 years ago as a second Lincoln, and Trotter's now the same as Villard. Like, why don't you be a statesman? Why don't you stand up here? The new freedom's like a new slavery. And now Wilson gets mad and tells Trotter, your tone, sir, offends me. No one has talked to me in such a tone. No one has come to this office and talked to me in such a tone. If this association comes again, it must have another spokesperson. Trotter just ignores this. I'm representing people. And we're going to leave the Democratic Party. You have spoiled your cause.
Nothing is as apparent in politics as like when you mistreat one of your friends. People notice that. The New York Age newspaper writes, "Don't take the people who waited on you, who supported you, and pat them on the head."
Now, Wilson is going to regret. He tells Tumulty that he regretted losing his temper. I played the fool on that one, and I turned an incident into an issue. It's an issue. Here's Du Bois again. We black men still vote, in spite of the fact that the triumph of your party last fall was possible only because Southern white men have, through our disenfranchisement, have from twice to seven times the political power of Northern white men. Notwithstanding this, we black men of the North have a growing nest egg, 500,000 ballots, and ballots that are counted, which no sane party can ignore. In other words, you can not count our votes in the South, which is going on, but in the North, they're counting our votes. Does your Mr. Burleson expect the Democratic Party to carry New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois by 200,000 votes? If he does not, will it not be well for him to remember that there are 237,942 black voters in these states? We've been trying to tell these voters that the Democratic Party wants their votes. Have we been wrong, Mr. Wilson? Have we assumed too great and too quick a growth of intelligence in the party that once made slavery its cornerstone? Again, he asked him directly a couple of questions at the bottom of the letter, like, do you want black votes? By the time we get to 1916, W.E.B. Du Bois, among all of these people, is going to answer that question for himself. The answer is no. Woodrow Wilson's not interested, and he, Du Bois, is not interested in Woodrow Wilson. In fact, he doesn't even want black voters to vote Republican. He wants them to vote for the Socialist Party. Now, when people study the closeness of the 1916 election, they are going to rightly study he kept us out of war and all of that. You're going to rightly study maybe that Hughes didn't say much, and we'll get into that. The impact of women voters. But you don't hear much about the African-American vote, and I think it's very important because the situation as it plays out is not very different from Mr. Du Bois' letter. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Illinois, New York, these are states that change. When you talk about this issue of Wilson because he was either too scared of his political support from Southerners or if he just harbors these feelings about African Americans, you see the disappointment of this voter group, and he's losing this voter group, and he even insults them, to be quite honest. He doesn't make an attempt to reach out. Really, and I'm going to get into this in episode 3, and we're going to call this like turning the election around or something like that, but really, as I approached this issue, I started to think about this differently. When there's a close election, just like a close athletic game, right? It's always about, wow, the miracle comeback. I can't believe this person won out. But a good coach, if you're using the metaphor of a game, will ask, well, how come the team played so poorly that it got to be so close? And I think that's the other way to look at 1916. I mean, look, spoiler alert, we know who wins this election. But I also, and I'm going to do this in the next episode, look at some ways that Wilson made it close, in some cases by his own doings and a few things that he couldn't avoid. This issue's one of them. Beware of the movie. So writes socialist candidate for President of the United States, Alan Benson. And he's got his eye on this new technology, which even in 1960, there were already 21,000 places where people can go watch moving picture plays. The great moving picture play has swept over the United States as a storm cloud filled with lightning might drive over the land, Benson writes. Another movie of the same sort has left New York and will soon put the fear of invasion into the hearts of millions. These moving picture plays are frauds. They are impressive only because of the art of the stage manager and the photographer. They almost benumb spectators into the belief that they are portraying events that may have actually happened.
On the movie screen, it's as easy to show George Washington burning an orphan asylum as it is to show him crossing the Delaware. Eugene Debs might have been right about Allen Benson's ability to write an explosive letter. And here he continues. The story of the war movie tells is as simple as it is horrible. During the Great War in Europe, America was warned to prepare. It did not. And a little later, New York is under bombardment. Skyscrapers come tumbling down. Washington is captured, and the United States is compelled to buy peace at the price of an enormous indemnity. I have observed how these plays have affected spectators. People seem dazed and leave the theater in a sober mood. I have heard people say, that shows what may happen to us if we don't prepare. But when the Civil War had closed, the movie had not been invented. If it had, one could imagine the type of play that could be put on. Now, Benson was born after the Civil War, but nonetheless, he talks about how if there were movies during the Civil War, it would have been possible for General Grant to be portrayed in a movie saying, I need an army even after the Civil War's over, of the same size. I need a million men just to protect our liberties because, well, those European nations are going to invade us while we're weak after the Civil War. Having commenced that war, we're weak. And not heeding Grant's warning, the movie will show America not prepared and warships sail with troops for the United States. It'll show Grant fighting stubbornly with the little army he's been given, but being pushed back, and only if we had prepared. No such play was written at the close of Civil War. Why? Because of its manifest absurdity? No, Benson writes. Far more probability would have been attached to a play than is attached to any of the dreams of the disaster that the preparedness gentlemen are dreaming now. We were then weak from war, and Europe was strong from peace. Now the conditions are reversed. There was no movie play because movies had not been invented. And we had no gentlemen engaged in building dreadnoughts at 18 million each. The ships of that day were small and cheap. We had no gentlemen engaged in selling armor plate to the government at prices ranging from $430 to $600 a ton. Now, Benson is right to warn about the power of the movie. That's going to happen later during the war period where the government will actually control and censor movies. The power of the movie is going to be seen in this period, most notably by D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. And the socialists, to their credit, are going to be some of the foremost speakers against that movie, pointing out how racist and wrong it is. And Woodrow Wilson allows a showing of Birth of a Nation at the White House. Now, there's Griffiths admit that he wasn't letting his intentions be known. Nonetheless, there you have it. It's being shown at the White House. So that shows you the position. And now, what Benson does not account for is that there are also anti-war movies. And one of them is D.W. Griffith's movie, Intolerance. Now, Intolerance to me is kind of a response to Birth of a Nation. When Birth of a Nation comes out, NAACP and other people protest it, and D.W. Griffiths gets all upset. Intolerance is his response. It's a huge movie, huge budget, going over large span of time, and basically making the point that people shouldn't be intolerant to other people's views. He shows the Pilgrims, the Babylonians, all kinds of other stories of history where people were intolerant, the Huguenots. But it's also an anti-war movie. So in an odd way, the socialists and D.W. Griffith are aligned at least on this one issue. Then you have the movie Civilization, the story of a U-boat commander that decides not to fire on a passenger line and everything that happens to him because of it. And though the events are fictionalized, it has a lot to do with what's going on. In this campaign, Benson will attack both Hughes and Wilson. He'll also have a lot of venom for Roosevelt, who he thinks is just not only wrong, but stupid, and a warmonger, and all of that. Roosevelt says he is devoted to peace, but he's about as passionately devoted to it as ducks are to the desert. There's the socialist take. So we talked about the political forces, and the parties had their conventions. In the next episode, we're going to look at the election. Now, what can 1916 tell us about 2024? That's what we get into in part three. I want to thank you for listening as always. If you can support us, we have a Patreon. If you can spread the word about the program, Reddit, we're getting some great coverage there. I appreciate it. And I thank you for listening.